Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. My colleague and co-host Sam is off today. The battle over voting rights has been one of the most contentious issues in American politics, certainly in the last five decades, but also in recent years. There have been notable moments of achievement. One of the most important is obviously the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and there have been many ongoing struggles to protect the rights afforded by that legislation, even though in recent years, as we've discussed on this program, we've been in a period of retrenchment where many organizations are fighting to overturn many of the gains that had been made over the past few years. And currently, even the President of the United States, President Trump, has often kind of lent rhetorical support to the claims that are used by opponents of voting rights. But it's an issue that we keep coming back to, given that it's at the heart of our democratic process. And today we're fortunate to have with us Professor Gloria Brown Marshall, who teaches constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She is also a civil rights attorney and the author of Race, Law, and American Society. She is an award-winning legal correspondent. She's also a playwright. And her columns on the U.S. Supreme Court have been syndicated and received considerable attention. She can be seen and heard often on the BBC, CNN, CBS, NPR, and more. And her recent book, which we'll talk about today, The Voting Rights War, the NAACP, and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice, came out with Roman Littlefield in 2016 and is available everywhere. It has received terrific reviews, and it's really a fantastic work, both of history and analysis. So, Professor, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
So maybe we could start by talking a little bit about the origins of this book, when you conceived of the project and why you decided that the history of the NAACP and using that as a window into voting rights was what you wanted to do.
Well, when I was an attorney with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, my area was Georgia, North Carolina, and Alabama. And I spent a lot of nights in little motels thinking about the civil rights struggle and how long people in the community had been challenging the system to gain rights for their children and for themselves. And so the impetus for most of my work that is taking place today actually started way back then. And the Voting Rights War, I think, really stimulated me in a way because it gave me a way to tell the story of the NAACP and at the same time tell the story of those voting rights martyrs, the people in the community, regular people who put their lives on the line, and many of them lost their lives. And we don't even know their names. And here they've sacrificed so much. And yet at the same time, after President Obama, I had a sense that people would not want to vote. The thrill of voting wouldn't be there, and they would stay away. And that's just what happened.
And many people obviously know what the NAACP is, or they've heard about it. But do you find that people have a good sense of the history of where the organization came from and the kinds of fights it was involved in until recent years?
I don't think it really is in the news the way it used to be. It's seen as an old-fashioned organization that's in the midst of change, and it is indeed changing to meet the needs of our 21st century issues. Many of them are the same issues, but they have to be addressed, taking into account successful mechanisms of the past as well as what we can do with social media, et cetera, to get people, you know, to come around and be a part of the struggle today. But the NAACP, because of the name, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, in the 21st century, it sounds so staid. And yet at the time, in 1909, it was an amazing organization that to be an integrated organization for one, and also be one to have as part of its precepts that it would fight for voting rights and fight against criminal justice issues that were discriminatory and fight for a place at the table. And W.B. Du Bois, you know, the Harvard graduate PhD who was the, I think, the greatest mind of the time, black or white, as part of that, it was an amazing organization. And the fight that you've read about in my book, The Voting Rights War, shows you that they were fighting in court, fighting as lobbyists, fighting in, you know, in the communities. They were an amazing organization, and that luster, unfortunately, has been lost over time.
I think one of the really interesting parts of the book that's relevant for current activists on civil rights and other issues is you describe almost a trifecta of strategies that the NAACP used: litigation, legislation, and protest, thinking at every level of politics, essentially, how to combat issues like the white-only primary. And it really comes through in the book how working at all of those different levels was one of the reasons they were so effective early on.
And I think today, because those mechanisms have been used separately, they haven't had the same impact, and people think that they do not work anymore. And I've had that discussion many times. Oh, protest doesn't work anymore. People go out and protest and no one thinks about it after like a week or so. But what they said was basically in the strategy, using all three with a common focus. And I think that's what's lost today. But if that could happen again, litigation, legislation, and protest with a common focus, I think great gains can be made once more.
What were so you have a chapter on the white-only primaries, which, again, I don't think everyone is familiar with what this was. Maybe you can walk us through how the NAACP chose this as one of their areas of focus, what it was, how it worked, and what it represented in terms of race and the democratic political system before the 70s.
Well, if we go back very quickly, the 15th Amendment in 1870 gave black men the right to vote. And the first black U.S. Senator, Hiram Revels, was in 1870. From that time period, from 1870 until about 1890, there were over 4,000 blacks in state, local, and federal government. And then a decision was made, how can we stop this black progress? Because the black vote was always able to change the outcome of an election, even in the 1800s. And that was understood. And so in 1890, in the Mississippi Convention, they developed these strategies to counter the black political power movement that was going on. The grandfather clause, white-only primaries, poll taxes, literacy tests, all those things were created during that time period. And as we go forward, 1915 is the first successful case involving the NAACP, and that was the case against the grandfather clause. But the white-only primary, and remember, the Democrats held the South because when the slaves were freed by Lincoln, a Republican, they switched from the Republican Party to the Dixiecrat Democratic Party. And so these cases are against the Democratic Party. And so the Democrats said, well, you know, the primary is just a club. And the Democratic Party is a party that's a private party. And we can decide our members, if you can keep that in mind, that they thought they could decide their members. And the Supreme Court agreed. And so they said, well, you know, you can vote in the general election, but we are going to have the primary election only for white voters. And the U.S. Supreme Court initially agreed and then figured out later, because the overwhelming vote was going to be for the Democratic politician, the candidate at the time. So if you didn't vote in the primary, your general election vote really didn't matter, because whoever won the primary was going to win the general election. And that's when the Supreme Court finally figured out, oh, okay, we have to have the primary open to all and not have it based on race alone.
And then you, as you just mentioned, two other mechanisms that are very important to disenfranchising African-Americans were the literacy test and the poll tax. You write, the poll tax burdened every black citizen who considered voting. Each resident was required to pay a yearly tax to the local jurisdiction. The tax may have helped the local schools, parks, and road maintenance. However, failure to pay the tax prohibited a citizen from voting. Although the amount was relatively nominal for poor farmers, sharecroppers, and anyone living in poverty, it was a financial burden that could not be overcome. And you also talk about the kinds of literacy tests that were enforced in in different states, including one case in North Carolina, where someone, Luis Lassiter, who you're writing about in the book, had to, in order to vote, read, or I believe write, a section of the North Carolina Constitution or the U.S. Constitution if they wanted to vote.
Yes, and just imagine, you know, we both work in academia, that we can give a test, that the student takes the test, or whomever the test taker is, takes the test, and then we tell them, you failed, but you can't see the test. You won't be told what you did wrong. You're just told you failed the test, and that's it. And for them to take any section of the state or U.S. Constitution and then have someone write an essay exam on that, And on that section without ever knowing what section is going to be used. I mean, these horrendous types of trick questions that were to the point of being complex math questions to word problems to how many jelly beans are in a jar and calculate that mathematically. I mean, these were the things that were put in the way of people. And when they did, for whatever reason, pass the test, they could. They were ejected from their sharecropping farm homes. They were tormented by neighbors. And then when they paid the poll tax, they had to pay it to the sheriff. So you can imagine you're now alerting the sheriff that you're a troublemaker because you want to actually exercise your right to vote.
And if there was a few years ago, there was a documentary on the civil rights movement that had pretty gripping images of what the courthouses looked like and the kind of police force that a person would encounter if they wanted to take the risk and try to register and vote. And it was physical intimidation in addition to all these processes which were pushing African Americans away from this right.
Very much so. And I think another reason why we take our rights for granted is because we don't have that type of physical intimidation. But there are other mechanisms. I mean, a photo ID and other hoops that it's understood that with each hoop, people will fall away and not exercise their right to vote. So even though it was physical intimidation then, there are still obstacles in place today that are undermining the political process.
And before we get to today, I want to just kind of finish our history moment in the 1960s. And we're recording this on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King being killed. Tragic moment in American history, the loss of one of our greatest voices. And of course, in the 1960s, King had been instrumental to the mobilization that produced the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which President Lyndon Johnson ended up supporting and putting into law with a Democratic Congress. How important was the Voting Rights Act of 65 to rectifying some of the problems and challenges that the NAACP had been working on for decades?
It was instrumental. The Voting Rights Act, unfortunately, was seen by many as giving black people the right to vote. And, you know, the right to vote for black males, as I pointed out, was gained in 1870 with the ratification of the 15th Amendment. And women gained the right to vote with the 19th Amendment in 1920. However, the right to vote and the ability to exercise that right were two different things. And so in 1965, after the walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and I was honored to be among those who were there for the 50th anniversary of the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, it's just an amazing thing to think that here we have to have a march from Selma to Montgomery to bring the world's attention after the attack on the bridge by the Alabama State Troopers, that there are people who are citizens of the United States, have fought in the military, have paid their taxes, and yet have not been able to exercise their right to vote. So that great effort led by Martin Luther King, and in the movie Selma, I always cry a little bit every time I get to the end and hear his voice talk about that miraculous moment. It was very important for us to understand. And then, in, of course, later on to have that Voting Rights Act gutted by the Shelby County versus Holder case was just another moment that was tearful for all those in civil rights, and it should have been for those who believed in democracy.
Can I ask, what was King's relationship with the NAACP in that mid-60s period? What was it like? How did he relate? How did he interact with the organization and vice versa?
Well, this is really a special moment. I'm glad you asked that question for me, because Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian wrote the foreword for my book. And Dr. C.T. Vivian was Martin Luther King's friend, advisor, and first lieutenant in the cause. And there are actually YouTube videos of Reverend Vivian in Selma attempting to register to vote and being beaten by the sheriff there. And I recount that in the book as well. And so when I spoke with C.T. Vivian, as literally sitting in awe of him as he told me about his relationship with Martin Luther King, he said that basically Martin Luther King was a member of the NAACP, but because of the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Council, their own organization, that they had a relationship and almost a competition with the NAACP. But of course, with Thurgood Marshall and the other cases, Charles Hamilton Houston, the NAACP's lawyer and, you know, litigation and legislation strategy was one that separated the groups. So the law was what the NAACP focused on. The Christian and social justice strategy was one that Martin Luther King focused on. And then they met in the middle when it came to protest. So the NAACP, SCLC, and other organizations would come together. And that's what you saw at Selma, was the coming together of these different members who would join one or the other, or maybe two or three different organizations, but would come together when it meant protesting for these rights that they all believed in.
The NAACP by the 60s, how is it viewed in Washington if you were on Capitol Hill? Obviously, if you were talking to some of the Southern Dixiecrats, they probably didn't think much of the organization. But how did other members of Congress view it? Was it still seen as radical, like many people saw Martin Luther King? Or within Washington, had it become part of regular Washington politics by that time?
No, actually, it was still considered radical. It was considered radical until the 70s, the late 60s into the 70s. And the reason why it was considered radical was because they had a truly amazing radical lobbying arm. Even though they had, of course, the very respectful, dignified appearance, they were very fierce when it came to lobbying. And they made sure that even those members of Congress who did not appreciate them knew that they would be at the door talking about the issues. They would be well-versed and knowledgeable. So it was seen as this upstart organization that was going to be there. You couldn't turn around and just ignore it. It was going to knock on your door and put the issue on your table, on your desk, and you're going to have to address it. And because the NAACP had at that time a network of newspaper articles and of course the Crisis, its own newspaper that was being widely read, whatever these congresspeople did became a newsworthy item in the black newspapers, if not picked up by some of the white newspapers.
And now you've hinted at this in the conversation. You certainly talk about it in the book, but we're in a moment where it seems that some of these efforts they are under attack. And we've seen a rollback of certain gains from the 1960s, including the Shelby decision. And I was just looking at the preface or foreword from the Reverend, who writes at the end, "The Voting Rights Act was a major victory, but this fight over power is ongoing. Rich people want to give an illusion of shared power with the poor, but making it harder to vote is not sharing power." And then goes on to describe a little bit about what's happened. And you have a really terrific and important chapter in the book on vote dilution and photo identification laws and more. What's happened in the last decade or so to voting rights? Are we back in a situation that is as perilous as where we were in the 60s? Are we facing different kinds of threats now in terms of voter dilution? What are some of the big ticket problems that we have?
The big ticket problem is the same one from the very beginning. Whose voice is going to be heard? And the vote is the voice. And that vote is going to give the community and the country its marching orders. And we see from, you know, the going from President Obama to Donald Trump, that vote makes a difference. And too often, because that vote makes a difference, those people who are very well educated or, you know, highly financed believe that their insight into where the country should go is more important than the poor person or the person who doesn't speak English as a first language or the naturalized citizen or the person of color. And so there's always been a class war around the right to vote and who should lead this country. And that was part of the initial framers' reason for having an electoral college was that, you know, the riffraff, the common person, may be persuaded by a charismatic leader and not use their vote wisely. And so we have this electoral college that is put in place. So this sense of a class war, but there's also been this ongoing race war and this sense that is this country's identity a European-American identity, meaning that it's supposed to be led by people who are of European ancestry and not by other people of color, especially African-Americans and others. And that's an ongoing issue. So the class issue and the race issue, these remain issues that are going forward. We're dealing with them now. We were dealing with them before. And even though it's not a life and death issue so far, but we don't know. You know, it could be. It could revert. We didn't know we'd be in a situation we're in right now. So it may be as deadly today as it was before.
The Voting Rights Act was wounded by the Shelby decision, but it still stands. Could you talk about the wounds that that court decision inflicted on the legislation?
You mentioned before about President Lyndon Johnson supporting the Voting Rights Act. And it's really interesting because he grew up poor in Texas. He knew the racism, the discrimination, the bigotry of the Southern white, the Dixiecrats. He knew that these laws were discriminatory, and he knew that they were intentionally discriminatory against people of color, especially African Americans and Latinos. He knew all of that, and he was a Dixiecrat. He was someone who undermined the 1957 Civil Rights Act that many people don't know about. But when he was president of the United States, he knew also that people who were poor in Appalachia and other parts, poor whites, were people who needed to have their voices heard and their votes counted. And so he knew that not just the protection of the right to vote was necessary, but he put and had them put and made sure when he signed his legislation, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that those same states that had undermined the rights to vote of people of color would, if they wanted to change their laws, they would have to defend the reason for changing that law. And that defense has been a protection that has allowed the right to vote for people of color to grow. So in 2015, in the Shelby County case, the issue was whether or not the country had outgrown the need to have the federal government actually review or pre-clear the change in some law in one of these covered states. For example, Shelby County, Alabama, in order for it to enact a new voting rights law, it had to have that proposed legislation reviewed and pre-cleared by the federal government to make sure it was not discriminatory. That was the core, the heartbeat of the Voting Rights Act. That is what Lyndon Johnson knew was required, because he knew that these people were recalcitrant in their ability to hang on to white supremacy. That was what was gutted in the Shelby County case in 2015. That was gutted.
And it seems that we have a combination of that kind of protection, proactive protection of the vote, combined with this dilution of the vote through processes such as gerrymandering, combined with not explicitly racial efforts or class-based efforts to constrain voting, but laws that have that same effect, such as voter ID. It seems like that's the trifecta in some ways of the new opponents of voting rights.
Yes, and it's understood that with photo ID or with any obstacle to voting, that there will be a sense that a person is going to give up and go home. And I'm sorry, that was 2013 with Shelby County case. But it's been studied that if you move the polling place, people will likely not vote. because it's extra effort toward voting. And any extra effort that's required then will cut down the number of people who will actually exercise their right to vote. And since this has been studied, when Indiana passed their photo ID law, just like the other laws that have been passed before to undermine the right to vote, the court looks at whether or not there is a discriminatory purpose. Does it state on its face that this is to undermine the right to vote for particular people, especially African Americans or Native Americans or whomever? And if it doesn't, they say, oh, there's no problem. But they know the effect. And the effect is to undermine the right to vote of the poor. Because not only did Texas and other places begin to institute these photo ID laws and others within weeks of the Shelby County case, because they knew that these laws would undermine most of those people who are poor and people of color who are Democrats, and then give the advantage to the conservatives. And so this fight, again, is on its face. It was very clear in the early part of the 1900s going, and now it doesn't show on its face that it's discriminatory, but it's already been understood what the effect is going to be, especially with gerrymandering and other legislative tools.
What do you think the effect will be of President Trump's constant use of rhetoric about voting fraud, which, as we know, has no basis in the evidence? But to have a president talk about that all the time and to promote the concept, which is obviously the basis of all these voting fraud laws, do you think this will have long-term political ramifications, especially in the for the kinds of struggles you've now documented to protect votes?
I think it will. I mean, people may discount the role of the president in our day-to-day lives, but the White House and whoever is in the White House does affect the way people think. And if you say it long enough, people begin to, well, there must be something to it, or why would this be stated time and time again? Which goes back to something that I think is very important for us to understand, and this is the civil death. And the civil death is the felony disenfranchisement. And this connection between if someone has committed a felony, paid a price for committing that felony, and having served their time in prison, being incarcerated, they are released, and they should still be unable to vote. This idea that they, as a human being, they no longer have what they should, you know, in their mind be a person who's qualified to vote. They're no longer in some way, form a human being who should be able to have a voice in the community, even if they've already paid their price and for that act. And that sense that they have been tainted forever is something that people still cling to. And that's said time and time again with law and order politicians, that we should not give formerly convicted felons their right to have their voices heard through the right to vote. And people still believe that, even though there's nothing to really support it.
You find we're almost out of time, but I did want to ask, you also are a playwright. And so you work, not only have you worked in the law, not only are you working in universities and writing, but you have this other medium that you use. How did you get into playwriting?
Well, I probably started as a playwright first. and as a child, I used to write plays for my family, and we put them on in the garage. And I used to write short stories as well, and I'm working on my first novel. I think about all these issues, and I try to think about what is the best way to present it so that it can be understood. And communication is something that anybody wants to do, especially an artist, to be successful in. But my play Class, for example, is the one I'm working on now. And Class is about the struggle between this angry working-class white community and the middle-class black community. And there seems to be this struggle as though one cannot exist with the other. And that is, in my play, I work through how a Irish working class American student is in a school and angry because he didn't receive the grade he felt he should receive. And I think we've all been in that situation, but believes that, you know, someone has stolen his American dream, and that the entity, the group stealing the American dreams are these people of color, and especially African Americans. And that's something I wanted to bring for people to understand, and sometimes drama is the best way for us to understand these very emotional and conflicting issues. And race and racism, discrimination, prejudice are all emotional issues. They have no logic in their basis. And so I thought the stage play would be the best way to bring that forward. It's my seventh play, actually.
That's fantastic. And it resonates. We've had many conversations on this show, not only with journalists and professors or politicians, but also with people in the arts dealing with political issues, like Robert Schenken, who wrote All the Way, the play about Lyndon Johnson and the Civil Rights Act of 64. And we always find it's an incredibly effective way often, especially in this day and age, given what's going on in the political sphere, to grapple with these big questions that are so front and center on the minds of the electorate. Well, anyway, I want to thank you very much for joining our show. Once again, this is Professor Gloria Brown Marshall, and we've been talking about a fantastic book that I highly recommend, The Voting Rights War, the NAACP, and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice, which was published by Roman Littlefield and available everywhere. It's not only informative, but it's really a terrific read. So thank you again for joining our show.
Thank you. And as Vernon Dahmer said, if you don't vote, you don't count.
Well, thank you for that important message. And once again, you can find our podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.